Science writer Gary Tabbs has a knack for subverting conventional wisdom. 16 years ago, he published a groundbreaking feature in the New York Times magazine, arguing that decades worth of government-approved nutritional advice attacking fatty foods and praising carbohydrates was flat-out wrong, ideologically motivated, and was contributing to rising rates of obesity and diabetes. He was widely attacked, including in the pages of Reason. His 2007 book, Good Calories, Bad Calories, followed on that story, as did Why We Get Fat and What to Do About It, which came out in 2011. Today, his thesis is gaining ground among health and nutrition researchers and has been highlighted in places such as the New York Times and Time Magazine. I sat down with Tabbs at his kitchen in Oakland, California, to talk about his latest book on nutrition, The Case Against Sugar, which came out recently in paperback. Gary Tabbs, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thanks for having me.
Can you lay out the opening arguments that you make against sugar for us?
We have obesity and diabetes epidemics everywhere in the world, worldwide. They manifest whenever a population shifts from a whatever their traditional diet is to a westernized urban diet. And so you could think of the Western diet and lifestyle as the vector that carries obesity and diabetes into these populations. And the question is, what is it in that diet?
Describe the Western diet. Does that mean
processed food? Well, so that's a question. Processed food, sedentary living.
Totino's pizza rolls.
Could be pizza rolls, Kentucky Fried Chicken, McDonald's, Coca-Cola.
So the whole reason that we live, the things we wait for, are the things that are killing us.
It's a simplistic way to think about it, probably wrong, that things many of us live for. Anyways, this is the issue. Something in our diet and lifestyle causes obesity and diabetes. Conventional wisdom is it's basically caloric overload. We eat too much or we're sedentary, and the foods, you get too much food available. They're packaged in a way that makes them irresistible. They have too much salt, fat, sugar. There's a whole host of theories around that idea, but ultimately it comes down to we take in more calories than we expend. That causes obesity. Obesity increases your risk of type 2 diabetes. Both those diseases increase your risk of heart disease, cerebrovascular disease, stroke, cancer, Alzheimer's, you name it, every major chronic disease. And we see these chronic diseases appearing in populations when they make this nutritional shift. So the question is, what is it? And the argument I'm making in this book is that sugar is the prime suspect, always been the prime suspect, because you can track these epidemics back in time.
Now, you say it's always been a prime suspect, but really, you know, at least in the past 40 or 50 years, we've been told, and this is a lot of your work, what we've been told is don't worry about sugar, worry about fat, worry about the meat and that beautiful arc of fat around the edge that you might gristle up a little bit.
That's key to the story, and that's how I entered into it as an investigative journalist, is we had this belief system that began in as a hypothesis in the 1950s and was started to be tested in the 1960s and was never confirmed, which is that dietary fat causes heart disease.
When it comes to calories, fat is the enemy.
So by the 1980s, a healthy diet was being defined as a low-fat, low-salt diet.
And this explains Snackwell cookies and things like that.
What a delicious way to cut the fat. Snackwell's chocolate sandwich cookies.
One of the things that happened in the 80s when we embraced this low-fat, healthy diet synchronicity is the government, the CDC, started telling industry to produce low-fat foods. So we could take foods like the iconic example is yogurt. A high-fat food by definition. You remove some of the fat. Now you have this kind of insipid, watered-down, tasteless thing. And to make it taste good, you put back fruit and sugar, high-fructose corn syrup, and now you've got a heart-healthy diet food that you can sell in these little packets, and we see them everywhere.
Did the shift from a higher-fat or a more balanced diet, actually, to a low-fat, low-salt sugar, did it achieve the goals that were predicted for it?
You could look at heart disease mortality, and it's come down. And the nutrition community said, well, look, people aren't dying from heart disease as much. Therefore, our advice is right. And then people like me say, yeah, but we're not interested in mortality because we're also selling billions of dollars in statins every year and billions of dollars in blood pressure drugs. And we're doing, you know, hundreds of thousands of heart surgeries a year, putting in stents, you know, doing bypasses. If mortality wasn't coming down, we'd have a real problem. The question is, what's happening to incidence? Are we seeing less heart disease because we're preventing it with changes in diet? And there's no evidence.
You know, you describe an early battle over many of these questions between academic nutritionists who overwhelmingly took the energy balance approach to nutrition. You know, you lose weight if you burn more calories than you take in, versus what they characterize as quack doctors.
So you have an academic research community that's dominated post-World War II in the U.S. by nutritionists who are studying animals for the most part. 1959-60, Rosalind Yalow and Solomon Burson invent the technology that allows hormones to be measured accurately. The science of endocrinology finally has the tools they need to understand things like hormonal regulation of fat accumulation. And Yalow and Burson say, look, insulin drives fat accumulation. So maybe this link between type 2 diabetes and obesity, maybe the type 2 diabetics are obese because of the insulin. And nobody cares. Because they know what, except the doctors. So the doctors are like all of us, they're getting fat, right? What do you do if you're getting fat? Well, you try what everyone tells you to do, which is eat less and exercise more. And if that doesn't work, which it doesn't, then you look, if you're smart, you look for other methods. So some of them read the diet book literature and try various diets. Some of them actually read the same medical literature I did. So Atkins famously read the same studies I read 40 years later. There's a conventional thinking that carbohydrates are fattening, bread, pasta, potatoes. You know, every woman described them as going right to their hips. Maybe if I get rid of the carbohydrates and replace it with fat, because fat's the one macronutrient that doesn't stimulate insulin secretion, maybe I'll lose weight. So if you try it and it works.
So it is a place where kind of people outside of the official research community were, you know, desperate to get skinny or have their patients get skinny, so they tried a bunch of different things.
Obesity is one of these subjects where it helps to have a weight problem. If you don't understand what it's like to get fatter and fatter, year in and year out, regardless of what you do, or to be 50 pounds fatter than your schoolmates in high school, regardless of what you do, you just don't understand obesity.
Were you, you're a trim guy, were you a fat load at some point in your life?
I was chubby when I was a kid. It was one of the interesting things, because my brother, who was a mathematician, was, you know, you could see every vein on his body, and I was a chubby, you know, he was taller and thin. He couldn't gain weight if he wanted to, and I was just a chubby kid. Puberty, you know, helped.
Yeah.
And then I became an athlete, and that helped. But my brother, at his peak, was 6'5", weighed about 195, was a rower. Remember, Freud said anatomy is destiny, so he rowed crew. And I was 6'2" and could get up to 240, and I played football. We both ate as much as we could. Yeah. That's what we did. We were kids, you know, and I often wonder, it's like, why would you possibly think that I was thicker than him because I ate more, exercised less? I was just thicker than him. That was my body.
In the book, you document a long history of public nutrition advice being intertwined with politics in this country. Yeah. So let's talk about the sugar lobby. How did King Sugar, you know, get its crown in the American economy and kind of in the American diet?
Well, sugar used to be very expensive. It's hard to grow. It only grows in specific and tropical regions. You can't just transport the sugar cane around the world and then refine the sugar out of it afterwards. You've got to get the sugar out quickly on refining. It's a horrible job.
It was done by slaves.
So it was done by slaves. The sugar industry is at the heart of the slave trade. The Industrial Revolution comes along beginning in the late 18th century, and suddenly sugar gets cheaper and cheaper to refine. In the 1840s, the candy industry, the chocolate industry, and the ice cream industry all start up. The soft drink industry in particular just explodes. By 1900, we're consuming about 90 pounds per capita, which is almost a 20-fold increase in that century. Every industry, it's like an arms race. Nutritionists say no, and the marketers say if we don't do it also, we're out of business, and they fall one after another. And by the 1960s, you've got cereals that are 40-50% sugar and
that are advertising, etc. Right? This is like Sugar Smacks.
Honey and sugar make it different and wonderful. A circus of fun to eat.
You've got all of the like the smartest minds in Madison Avenue in the PR industry creating not just cartoon characters to sell, but entire Saturday morning cartoons, the ones we grew up on, like Rocky and Bullwinkle. I loved Rocky and Bullwinkle.
The cereal that gives you jet your wind.
It's fruit juices coming in the 1930s, okay? Sunkist, a coalition of California orange growers, don't know. They have to do something with their oranges. You can't sell enough and you can't move enough, so you turn them into juice, you sell them as juice, and you advertise them as healthy because of the vitamin C. We're coming off this age of the new nutrition, which was all about vitamins and vitamin deficiency diseases. You go back to what we evolved to eat and the sugar in those apples, and kids are now getting that within 20 minutes of waking up in the morning, and they're not going more than an hour and a half, 2 hours over the course of the day with that. You know, in the course of a day, they're consuming almost a year's worth of what they evolved to eat.
And you're, you know, at various points, the USDA or other government agencies that kind of gave dietary recommendations wouldn't even think to say, oh, well, you know, glasses of apple juice or orange juice or sugar.
To this day, when you're told to eat a lot of fruits and vegetables, it's because they're vitamin rich. In one, the conventional thinking, orange juice is healthy because it's full of vitamins. And in the alternative thinking, the world I live in now, it's unhealthy because it's basically sugar water. You could take Coca-Cola and the vitamin C, you know, tablet, and you got the same thing.
Talk about why the government would kind of push that or would have that blind spot and the role of the sugar industry.
Okay, well, the sugar industry, always a very powerful lobby because sugar was a very, it was a vital product, import. The food industry was dependent on it. So the sugar lobby was always considered incredibly powerful. Beginning in the 1920s, the industry creates a sugar association basically to help advertise sugar consumption. Post-World War II, when the artificial sweetener industry begins to come of age, people start thinking, hey, you know, I'm getting fatter. I could drink these sugar-free, calorie-free drinks as well. And the industry starts producing it. And the newspapers now have something to measure, which is the amount of diet sodas being produced, so they can write about the diet craze. And the sugar industry has a problem because people are saying sugar's fattening. So the Sugar Association starts saying, calorie's a calorie. That's the general, the bedrock belief of the nutrition obesity community. So they start advertising widely and starting PR campaigns to combat this argument that sugar is fattening. And they do it by basically just taking what the nutritionists are giving them. The nutritionists are giving them bad science. The obesity researchers are giving them bad science, and all serves to exonerate sugar.
Is the sugar lobby actually paying for studies, or are they paying?
They are paying for research.
For...
They began paying for research in World War II, but that, again, that was common practice. The sugar industry kind of pioneered it. I don't think they did it for public relations reasons. Mm-hmm. They wanted to find other uses for sugar. So they funded some of the best sugar biochemists in the world, and they wrote about it in Science Magazine, would annually run articles about the sugar industry, you know, who they were funding and why they were funding it, because it was a good thing. It helped cement some allies later, because if somebody's been paying your bills for 20 years, you tend to be fond of them. And that's where the conflict of interests come in. And then in the 1960s, with this idea that dietary fat was a problem, dietary fat caused heart disease, some of the people pushing that happened to be longtime recipients of sugar industry largesse. Now they could pay those people to write articles saying dietary fat is a problem, not sugar. And this was conventional thinking. The only people who were claiming sugar was a problem were these sort of fringe British nutritionists who were perceived as quacks.
So what about the attack on artificial sweeteners? So saccharin, or certainly cyclamates was banned in the late 60s, early
70s.
Yeah. Saccharin was almost banned, or it was for a bit, but it carries a warning
banned,
on it.
Yeah.
Where did the interest in saying these were carcinogenic or these
were
problematic?
Well, that came from the sugar industry. So the saccharin and cyclamates were direct competitors. Interestingly, here's where the beverage industry and the sugar industry split, because the beverage industry was happy to sell artificial sweeteners are cheaper. But the sugar industry saw it as a direct threat to their viability, and it was. And there's a quote in the New York Times that I quote in my book, a sugar industry executive, copping to spending $500,000 on research trying to find anything that artificial sweeteners does that's damaging. They would give female rats the equivalent of 60 cans a day of soda and then hope that they would produce rats with birth defects so they could say, you know, it's as bad as thalidomide. I mean, they were looking for anything. Yeah. And this executive in the New York Times is quoted as saying, if someone could undersell you 1 cent to a dime, wouldn't you throw a brickbat at them if you could?
If our government and other public health institutions, universities, whatnot, if they're consistently offering bad nutritional advice and bad dietary guidelines, what do you do about that? What's the response?
That's the problem, isn't it?
So, because is there a solution here, or do we just kind of say, screw it, and, you know?
In the sciences in which I was raised, so physics and the people who taught me science when I wrote my first two books in physics and chemistry, the hard sciences, it's the last thing you want to do is get an assumption accepted into the theory of how things work without rigorously testing it, because then people will build on it from there and it'll grow and infect the whole sort of thought construction, and you end up with, I'm going to beat this metaphor to death, sort of a house of cards. And there'll be no way to go back on it. And those are sciences that have no influence on everyday life. So in a field like nutrition and obesity research, you've now got these enormous institutional dogmas built in that you know, I and others are arguing are simply wrong. Mm-hmm. Who do you trust? And how do you get the institutions to change their belief system? So right now, I'm, you know, co-authoring an article. The British Medical Journal is running a series on nutrition policy, and their way of dealing with it is by assigning writers from these different belief systems. So I'm a co-author on an article on dietary fat along with a former head of the Harvard Nutrition Department who thinks I'm the worst journalist he's ever met, and who does a form of science that I consider a pseudoscience.
But that is kind of the Enlightenment model of science, right? That you have competing truth claims and you kind of put them in, you know, a cockfighting ring.
Well, so what's the cockfighting ring? That's the key. Yeah. And the cockfighting ring is experimental tests. It's a hypothesis and test. You have a hypothesis, you do an experiment, you intervene, limiting the number of variables you change. The problem with these sciences, which is you can't really test these hypotheses. They're too hard to do. I mean, you could if you had enough societal motivation. If you're willing to spend $10 billion the way we do to try and find out if the Higgs boson exists in high energy physics and build, you know, you get everyone to work together, you identify the key questions, and you spend whatever money is necessary.
Food producers, you know, obviously they have, you know, institutional legacies that they want to protect, but they also, I mean, private industry spends billions of dollars a year on research. Are they capable of doing disinterested research?
Well, the assumption is no.
Yeah.
So, you know, nowadays there's a whole journalistic industry of identifying conflicts of interest when researchers do take money from industry. There are models which work better, where you just have the industry, you know, donate basically money for research to clearing houses or the government, which then identifies what things have to be studied. But, you know, if I'm right, the arguments I'm making is you have an entire multiple generations of nutrition and obesity researchers who really fundamentally don't know how to do science. They don't know how to think critically, how to keep multiple hypotheses in their head at one time, what it means to rigorously test hypotheses. So even if you had them do the studies, they would probably do a bad job.
At various points, you compare sugar to a drug, you know, to kind of go into a different register of government malfeasance. The government has arbitrarily declared certain drugs good and certain drugs illicit. The war on drugs has been a failure. Right. The war on tobacco, I guess, has been successful in terms of helping to drive down the amount of people who smoke. Are you proposing anything along the lines of a war on sugar?
No. Government interference worries me the same way I think it worries you guys. You know, this whole story is about government interference that went awry. If they had stayed out of things in the 60s through the 80s and never inflicted us with this, what I think are incorrect ideas that a healthy diet is inherently sort of low in fat, low in salt, The scientists might have had the time to get the science right, and we might have really understood what's happening.
And there is that structuring thing where obviously, and I guess this actually came up in the Obamacare debates about whether or not the government could mandate you buy broccoli, et cetera. It's never as direct as that, but when the FDA, or I guess more likely the USDA, the Department of Agriculture, sets up federal guidelines, those influence how people talk about things, how grants get given, what gets served at school lunches, which then changes tastes, et cetera.
Yeah.
So there's a real indirect power by which the government really does get to set a lot of dietary practice.
Yeah. And I have what is maybe too simplistic a notion. You know, we have these obesity and diabetes epidemics. Let's unambiguously identify the cause. And now we know what we shouldn't be eating. And if we get that message across, I don't know how much government regulation helped people cut back on smoking and how much the awareness that smoking causes lung cancer did. I didn't quit because of government regulations. I quit because I didn't want to kill myself. And I was coughing all the time, and it was clear that was cigarette related. So if we could get people to understand, if assuming I'm right, sugar is the problem, and you get rid of sugar and refined high glycemic index carbs, if you don't want to be obese and diabetic, I think, you know, those are awful disorders. Diabetes prevalence in this country has increased 700% since the early 1960s. Mm-hmm. We have to get that straight. As long as we think it's eating too much and exercising too little and sedentary behavior, and the obesity diabetes community will say these are multifactorial complex diseases, which means the NIH funds thousands of researchers to look at hundreds of things, and we're going to say it's all a little bit of this and a little bit of that. Some things triggering the epidemics everywhere, and it's probably the same thing everywhere. And no hypothesis would be it's something simple. And sugar's not just at the scene of the crime when it happens in populations, it's at the scene of the crime in the human body, which is the liver. There is a cause. And if we understand that, then I think there'll be a societal move to fix it. But again, we have to get it right. We have to get the science right.
All right. Well, we will leave it there. We have been talking with Gary Taubes. He's a science writer whose most recent book is The Case Against Sugar, out in paperback. Gary, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thank you, Nick.
For Reason, I'm Nick Gillespie.